Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Gaetis, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Kalatowski, the Honorable Theodora Gaetis presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This morning, we have three cases scheduled for oral argument on our calendar and two cases scheduled for non-oral conferences. I just have a few preliminary remarks that I'd like to make to the attorneys. We are recording this proceeding today on the Zoom platform. Of course, we're here on Zoom due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The recording of the hearings this morning will be available shortly on our website. No other recordings are permitted, however. All of the regular rules of decorum do apply with a few additions. Because we are on Zoom, if we happen to lose anyone this morning, of course, we will wait until everyone is together before we continue. I would also just ask the attorneys to please mute yourselves when you are not presenting your argument so that we don't have any interference with our sound. The first case on our calendar this morning is BDS Laundry Management Co. versus Haven LLC et al., case number A20-1223. And before we jump into our arguments, I will just note that the appellant will have 15 minutes to present argument. The respondent will have 15 minutes to present argument, and the appellant will have the opportunity for a 5-minute rebuttal. And just nod, attorneys, do you see the timer that should be in the corner of your screen? Okay, so that will be keeping your time this morning. And then finally, before you begin your arguments, please introduce yourselves. And we can now proceed with the appellant's argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mark Stephenson on behalf of the appellant BDS Laundry Management Company. This case fundamentally involves the lease between the parties and the right of first refusal that exists between BDS and the respondents. This lease was negotiated between the parties. As noted in the complaint, there was a series of negotiations that occurred. BDS wanted the right of first refusal in the lease. Stephen Scott and Haven did not. Obviously, we are here as a result of a Rule 12 motion. The standards regarding to that Rule 12 decision have to apply here. With regards to the lease, and obviously that's what we're here about today, we need to read the contract as a whole. That's what Minnesota law requires. We have to give meaning to all the terms of the agreement. We have to give their plain and ordinary meaning. And we must give meaning to the whole contract and to the various clauses. It's very simple here. We have the non-renewal rights clause that's at dispute. It's a straightforward clause that provides for certain obligations and rights if lessor decides not to renew the lease. Proceeds forward for a series of processes whereby there's a requirement to have a commercially reasonable proposal. A commercially reasonable lease is defined. The lessor then has to provide an executed copy of the lease to the lessee. And then the lessee has 30 days from the receipt of the executed lease to notify the lessor that it will substantially match the terms of the lease.
So Mr. Stephenson, if I could direct you toward the language that is used in this particular provision of the contract. The district court found that this provision provided simply an opportunity and not a right of first refusal. And in looking at the plain language of the provision, there's a lot of language to support the district court's conclusion. Is your entire argument based on the word match, or you know, what's your best argument based on the language of this provision that this was indeed a right of first refusal?
Well, I think that it is directly related to the phrase substantially match. The courts have looked at rights of first refusal historically in Minnesota and elsewhere, and determined that the word match is equivalent to a right of first refusal. I think that it's very clear that Minor versus Skog, the Supreme Court initially looked at those and talked about the need to, if you're going to execute your rights on a right of first refusal, you have to match the terms. Subsequently, in the Park Lane case back before the Supreme Court back in the 80s, the court was faced with a similar situation. And I think that it's important to recall their actual language. They talked about that it was at page 412 of their opinion in Park Lane. They talked about the fact that the holder of the right must match the terms of the offer. It went on to then later say on page 412 that the right of first refusal provision requires that the holder match the purchase price by the third party to the lesser in a cash transaction. The word match in Minnesota clearly provides the right of first refusal. It is the operative language that corresponds to a right of first refusal.
Well, it's not necessarily that's what your argument is. So can I ask you a quick question, though? If
sure.
You're done, is that okay, Judge Gaitis? Okay, I didn't want to interrupt the response here. But I mean, one thing that's troubling me about this paragraph is the fact that there's already an executed contract. So in order for BDS to maintain this, it requires, that's peculiar. I mean, it either requires the respondent to breach another contract or somehow or another negotiate their way out of it. That seems quite contradictory to there being a real right of first refusal.
Well, first of all, I think that here the parties fully understood that this provision was provided for a specific reason, which was back in this time period, there was a series of situations where false and fake offers were being proposed to avoid rights of first refusal. So the parties put in place, in these, essentially there's probably three or four competitors in this industry in Minnesota and in the upper Midwest. Some of these things are being done. And so in order to avoid that and have an actual real proposal, that was put in these type of contracts by these parties. As Mr. Lindell admitted at the district court hearing, that there was an ability for his clients to get out of this contract if they so desire. That's what he said. He said at page 4 of the transcript that they had the opportunity, they had the ability to get out of this lease if they so desired. I think that corresponds to the understanding here of the parties. It gives a real offer. It gives a real proposal. It isn't fake. And they have a direct ability to get out of it. Stephen Scott is probably the largest apartment manager in the state. They know what these contracts require. And they knew exactly how to get out of it. And as admitted by Mr. Lindell, they had that ability. So I think that that addresses that issue. I think that, you know, the executive, that type of contract was also reflective of a couple of other issues in the non-renewal paragraph. The reason why the commercially reasonable phrase is in this non-renewal rights paragraph is because what was happening in the industry was also something very similar, which had to do with non-commercially reasonable proposals were being made at the time that really dealt with, for instance, I'll give a new contract for a month and require you to put in brand new equipment. That's obviously not commercially reasonable. You can't make back your investment on new equipment in a month. And so the commercially reasonable term was put in there. And then
can I ask you just one other question?
Sure.
So is it your position that the lease is not ambiguous, that we can just look at the plain language?
I believe that our interpretation of this contract is correct and makes it so it's direct forward. If the court looks at Mr. Lindell's argument, I think that there can be an ambiguity created if the court is unsure as to which provision applies. That's what allows this to be remanded back to consider whether that is ambiguous. It's certainly, if our interpretation is not accepted by this court, we believe that it is ambiguous. We believe that the discovery in this case will show that the parties fully understood what this paragraph meant, that they had negotiated repeatedly over the years, that this was a right of first refusal, that it had been treated over the years as a right of first refusal, because when competing offers were received in the past, Mr. Shackman, who was one of the principals of Stephen Scott, would provide the proposal to Pat Redden of BDS, and then the new proposal would be met, and they'd move forward. I think that,
but isn't it, you keep using the term right of first refusal, but nowhere is that term present in the lease agreement. And wouldn't that be a simple way to make it clear that that's what this is all about?
If the right of first refusal language is in there, I think that that would have been simpler, yes. But I think the reality is that if you look at the argument of counsel and you look at the argument of Stephen Scott, what they're saying essentially is that if the provision was entitled right of first refusal instead of non-renewal rights, they admit that the language that corresponds in the paragraph constitutes a right of first refusal. The lease itself says that titles don't change the meaning of the contract and don't have an impact. Here, there's no dispute that the language that is used corresponds to the language that Minnesota Supreme Court has found is a right of first refusal, and which other courts throughout the country have found corresponds to a right of first refusal. The two out-of-court cases that we've cited,
Mr. Stephenson, so aside from the problem that we have with the title of the provision, I just want to go back to what you were saying about the way that this process would work under the contract. It doesn't seem to me like it would work as a normal right of first refusal would. So you'd have the parties, one of the parties deciding not to renew the contract, then getting into an executed contract with a competitor. And at that point, then BDS would have the right to present an offer. And then the follow-up to that would be that the apartment building would have to get out of an executed contract. Is that what you're saying the sort of normal process would be?
Well, I think that here, essentially what happens is that with the executed contract, we receive the terms and then we match those terms or substantially match those terms. And then they would have a direct ability to get out of the contract. The apartment owner knows that this right of first refusal exists, and they certainly would tell the competitor that this right of first refusal exists, and that if they match the terms of the agreement, we are going to have to move forward with BDS and not with you. And I think that that's what Mr. Lindell's comment at the hearing actually reflected. That's what the...
Okay, so just to follow up on that, is that the way a right of first refusal typically works?
Well, the way a right of first refusal typically works, I think, is this way, which is that you receive from the third party through, in this situation, the lessor, the terms, you're given the terms, you match those terms, and that acceptance of those terms constitutes the new lease. That's what happens here. It's identical, because what happens here is that we get the terms from, in this situation, Haven or Stephen Scott, and we, as we did here, we indicated that we matched those terms, and that offer by them and our acceptance creates the new contract, and we move forward and continue to be in the space as the lessee of the tenancy.
But counsel, isn't the more common language match the terms of the offer? In fact, the case you cited earlier to us, that's the exact language you read to us, match the terms of the offer. Here, we're not talking about an offer anymore. We're talking about an executed copy of the lease. And I know you've offered some comments about practices in the industry, but but I don't think we look at parole evidence like that in a Rule 12 review, do we? Don't we look at the four corners of this document and the words that were chosen?
Well, we look at the four corners of the document. The four corners says that we have the right to substantially match the terms of such lease. And here, that's what we did. We matched the terms of the lease, and then we move forward. I think that this is identical to what rights of refusal require. We did that, and we should have the tenancy. That is how this process had worked. And I think that, you know, in a Rule 12 motion, we have to have all the allegations in the complaint considered as true. Certainly here, the allegations are very clear that this process was negotiated. I think that one of the things that is also in the paragraph in the complaint at paragraph 33 was an allegation that Stephen Scott reflected when it refused to provide us the lease that we couldn't match the offer, that we didn't have the ability to match the offer. And so that clearly reflected that their understanding was is that we had the ability to match the offer. You know, I think that one of the things that they talk about here is that essentially if that you take their assumption as correct, there is no meaning to this paragraph. They talk about this as being a valuable right. And, you know, that essentially it's a valuable right. But, you know, BDS has been in this location for at least 7 years. They know the collection history. They know the types of machines. You know, this is a small industry. They know the competitors' costs to buy new equipment. We know essentially what their bid will be. There's, you know, as such, you know, the valuable right is really not all that valuable, which then brings us sort of to the breach of contract claim. Certainly, as set forth in the complaint, they absolutely refused to provide us with the offer or their lease, executed lease. They refused to do so. That's an obvious breach of contract. They claim these are valuable rights. They denied us our valuable rights. We alleged in the complaint that this failure was a breach of contract, and as such, we need to be able to move forward. The court more or less ignored that argument. And certainly we have a breach of contract claim here that needs to be remanded to the district court. And that being the case, I believe the remainder of the case should be remanded as well. I see that my time has run out.
Thank you, Mr. Stephenson. You will have the opportunity to provide a brief rebuttal, and I do hope that you do because I would like to discuss the breach of contract claim a little more. At this point, however, we will hear the argument for respondent. Mr. Lindell, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm here today on behalf of the respondents, Haven and Stephen Scott Management. Just a brief factual background. So the lease was for laundry rooms at Haven's properties where BDS supplied the laundry room equipment. It expired in February 2020. The operative language is, the focus is the non-renewal clause that comes into play at the expiration. There's no dispute as to what it says, and there's no dispute that it is clear and unambiguous. This is something that both of the parties took that position in the district court. Both parties stated flat out, this is a clear and unambiguous document. So I don't think we should be hearing any argument to the contrary this late in the game. That's both parties agree. This is a clear and unambiguous term. There's no dispute that Haven has the right under the non-renewal clause to lease the laundry room to someone else, a replacement lease after the term expires. If they do so, Haven has to provide BDS with a copy of that replacement lease. There's no dispute that Haven did lease the laundry rooms to a competitor. And there's no dispute that they did subsequently and after demand and initial refusal, provide a copy of that replacement lease to BDS as they're required to do under the contract.
So Mr. Lindell, with regard to your last comment that a lease was ultimately provided, is that something that's even a part of the record that this court can consider? And if so, how, where and how?
Certainly. So I can look up the specific site to that, Your Honor, but this was provided to the district court in an affidavit in connection with the motion to dismiss, which is document number 11 in the record and Exhibit A. That correspondence enclosing the executed lease that was provided to BDS as required by the contract was accepted into evidence, wasn't objected to by BDS, and so it formed a part of the record in front of the district court on the motion to dismiss. No request to turn it into a summary judgment motion, no objection by BDS. So that's how the court knew that the course of correspondence between the parties had continued and had resulted in Haven meeting its contractual obligation to provide a copy of the lease. And because there's no time limit on that obligation, the lease says they have to do it, they did do it. So the court correctly saw that there was no factual dispute here, there's no issue. They did comply with their contractual obligations, and that was appropriately dismissed. And certainly, BDS has not offered any authority or argument to explain how, when it's clear from the matters in front of the court on that record that the contract was complied with, dismissing the breach of contract claim was somehow an error. So I think the real issue for the court, or the biggest issue, is the contention that the district court erred in determining that the non-renewal clause does not contain a right of first refusal. And I think there's really two ways of looking at that. The sort of the plain language side, what does it actually say? And from the interpretation side, you know, when we read deeper into it, what does it tell us about the intent of the parties? And on the plain language side, the language is plain and unambiguous. And you kind of ask yourself, what is BDS trying to enforce? You know, is that language there? BDS says it has a right to the copy of the replacement lease. Yep, that language is there. BDS says it has a right of first refusal, but the contract doesn't say that. And there's no dispute there, it's clear. It does not use the magic words that people often use instead of being more particular. For example, right of first refusal. It's not there. BDS is trying to enforce what it claims is a preferential right to the premises, right? A preferential right. We get it before anybody else gets it, which is the heart and soul of what a right of refusal is. And that's in all the Minnesota cases that you look at on this topic, was cited by us and by BDS. The heart and soul of a right of first refusal is the owner cannot transfer the property away without first giving an opportunity to the right holder to take that property. That language isn't there. BDS says.
Can I just ask about the reasonable commercial lease provision of this passage that we're examining? What does that mean? Does that mean that if it's not a reasonable commercial lease, then BDS gets to continue, notwithstanding an executed contract with someone else?
Well, it's an interesting clause. Frankly, I don't think it's beautifully drafted to be fully self-explanatory. I think it's reasonable to look at it as being something that was put into the contract in order to make sure that there wasn't, I don't know, some very strange, non-ordinary substitute or replacement lease that was entered into. That's just not something that we've delved into, because the issue on the motion to dismiss and before this court, it turns on whether or not BDS has a right of first refusal. And there's been no arguments or contention that the replacement lease that was entered into by Haven was somehow less than commercially reasonable.
So it's your position that that provision shouldn't factor into our decision in any way as to whether this is a right of first refusal?
I think that's right. Certainly it's not something that the parties have spent time on in the briefs or on argument. Regardless of what that clause has to do with a commercially reasonable lease, right of first refusal consists of the right holder's right to enter into the premises before anybody else. The owner is precluded from transferring the premises to somebody else before they're giving the right holder the opportunity. None of that language is in that clause. And Minnesota law is clear that restrictions on transfers of real property, you have to use established technical terms like right of first refusal or first option, or you have to use other terms that clearly and definitely, and that's the terms from King v. Dalton Motors, that clearly and definitely express that the lessee has the preferential right. right? They're first in line. That's what a right of first refusal is. That whatever words you use, that's what the lease has to say. BDS is first in line. You can't give this property to anybody else. And clearly it doesn't say that because as this panel has pointed out, this is completely different than ordinary rights of first refusal or than any right of first refusal recognized by Minnesota courts, because it absolutely gives Haven the right to enter into a replacement lease before BDS even gets a chance to look at it. All of the cases that you look at talk about the right to match an offer. BDS is not correct in saying that any Minnesota court has said that the word match is what makes the right. What they were talking about was, in order to exercise a right of first refusal, you have to match that offer. If somebody offers 500 grand, you can't come in at 200 and say that you've properly exercised your right of first refusal. None of the Minnesota courts said that the word match is what let them know that this was a right of first refusal. And we've quoted the language from each of those cases in our briefs. The courts have been, go ahead, Your Honor.
Excuse me, counsel. But then under your reading of this lease, and we look at, of course, at all of the language, what's the purpose of that last sentence? Lessee shall have 30 days from the receipt of the copy to notify lessor that it will substantially match the terms of the lease. Under your reading, how does that fit into any kind of scheme?
It means exactly what it says, Your Honor. They get a right to see that contract. That's the right that they bargained for.
It doesn't say see it, though. It says, well, says they have that they will substantially match the terms of the lease.
That's right. And as Mr. Stephenson pointed out, there is a theoretical opportunity there. And as I said to the district court, it is not impossible for the property owner to repudiate the replacement lease and enter into a new lease with BDS if it chose to do that. That's what the district court was asking me, the reference to page 4 in the transcript. And I wanted to be very clear. We're not taking the position that entering into a replacement lease somehow makes it impossible for BDS's substantially matching offer to be meaningful. It's not. Any contract can be broken, or you could otherwise negotiate an exit, with that replacement lessee. But the really important thing here is that a right of first refusal would give BDS the right to force Haven to breach or repudiate or negotiate out of that lease. A right of first refusal would say that when BDS makes that offer to match, that that executes an acceptance of Haven showing them that replacement lease in the first place. And none of that language is there. You would have to completely rewrite this clause in order to make it say what BDS needs it to say in order for it to satisfy Minnesota law and become a right of first refusal. And let's be clear, some of the evidence that was put into the record by BDS shows that they had 16 other leases with Stephen Scott that used the terms right of first refusal. And it has nothing to do with the paragraph headers. That's not our argument at all. They got 16 other leases with some of these same parties that say BDS has a right of first refusal. So they know how to do it when that's the intent of the parties. And so when we're asking about the intent of the parties, when they don't use language that they clearly know how to use, sophisticated arm's length transactions, well, I think that tells us a lot about the intent. In order for this to be what it needs to be under King v. Dalton, it would have to clearly say that BDS has the preferential right, whatever words, doesn't have to be magic, but that BDS has that preferential right to get in first. And that if they match a replacement lease, then we have to accept that offer. It doesn't say anything like that. And rewriting it's completely inappropriate. And BDS says that the right to see what its competitors are offering isn't valuable, but that's hindsight. That was the only right to see this and make an offer and see if Haven wants to accept it. That was the right that they negotiated for. That was sufficient consideration at the time that they executed this document. Looking back and saying, actually, we wanted something different. We wanted a right of first refusal. That's not a reason that would justify a court rewriting the document in that way. And they could have easily just put the words right of first refusal or something similar in it in the first place. They knew how to do that, and they didn't. So under BDS's argument, the court would have to rewrite it in order to make it say that BDS has the preferential right that courts recognize, and it doesn't. The second way of looking at this is to dig deeper into the plain language to interpret what it means. And I've touched on this briefly, but the major cases, Park Lake Car Wash, Dirdall v. Golden Nugget, Abrahamson, and Minar v. Skoog, all of those use specific language that clearly shows that the right holder had that preferential right. And they say it in different ways, but they all have that in common. You have the right to match an offer, and the owner cannot transfer this property away without first giving you this opportunity on this offer. And that's an important distinction, because it's an opportunity to match an offer, not an opportunity to match an already executed contract. And I think that's what's at the heart of all of these. And it's the same issue in the non-Minnesota cases that they've cited. Every single one of these is an opportunity to match an offer that's paired with language, making it clear that the owner does not have the right to transfer this property to someone else without first giving that right of first refusal holder their opportunity. That language doesn't exist here. No Minnesota case has ever held that the word match by itself without additional preferential right language creates a right of first refusal. What BDS is asked the district court and is asking this court to do would be to make completely new Minnesota law, because that would be a brand new decision that no one has seen before. If the parties had intended the lease to include a term as important as a right of first refusal that would give BDS the right to force Haven into a new lease, force Haven into breaching, repudiating, or negotiating out of the replacement lease, then they would have expressly said so in the contract. They knew how. And they have to expressly say so in the contract under King v. Dalton. Giving BDS the power to force respondents into a new 7-year commitment in this way, force them to breach a lease with another competitor, would be an enormously significant transfer of power and discretion away from the people who own and manage the property. If that's what they intended, they would have said so, and they did not. Because they didn't include any of the terms, the preferential rights, you can't get rid of this property and give it to somebody else before giving BDS their opportunity. They didn't include any of those terms. So their intent is clear, and we are confined to the four corners of this document because both parties agree that is plain and unambiguous. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Lindell. And now we will go back to you, Mr. Stephenson. Let's just take a moment here to get the clock reset. Okay, you now have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that clearly we need to address what this non-renewal rights paragraph actually means and how we give it meaning. When you listen to the respondent's answer, essentially this provision has no meaning. Because when the leasee is given 30 days to indicate that it will substantially match the lease, it can only mean one thing, that when it indicates that it's matched the lease, that it's accepted the terms of the third party and it's going to move forward under this right of first refusal. I think that it's interesting to note that clearly they don't deny that if this said, instead of non-renewal rights, it said right of first refusal, that this paragraph would correspond to a right of first refusal paragraph. That is simply what it says and what it enacts. Obviously, the commercially reasonable language in the lease would be meaningless if it didn't give a right to a right of first refusal. There'd be no purpose to this paragraph.
Mr. Stephenson, I want to talk for a moment about the clear requirement in the contract that that a competitor lease, executed competitor lease, is provided. Are you making some kind of a separate claim here regarding the failure on the part of Haven to provide timely a copy of the executed competitor lease?
Yes, we have. That's a fundamental breach of the contract. There's essentially two breaches that have occurred here. One is the refusal to provide the copy of the executed lease as required by the contract, and two, the refusal to fulfilled their obligations under the rights of first refusal to then enter into the new lease.
Okay, so turning to the first claim here, what kind of damages, if we conclude that there is no right of first refusal, would BDS suffer as a result of the failure to provide the executed lease?
Well, the argument that has been provided by respondents is straightforward, that these are valuable rights. That's their position. Obviously, they denied us access to what they consider to be valuable rights. At this point in time, this is a Rule 12 motion. We've obviously alleged that we are damaged. We do not know, because we haven't been allowed to do any discovery, what exactly all happened here, what damages we've actually incurred. But certainly their argument is that we have the access to this information. It provides us with a better competitive advantage within the marketplace. And that's what we bargained for. That's what their argument is. And if we didn't get that, there are damages out there because of potential lost contracts that we would have otherwise obtained, but for the failure to provide the contract timely. That's their argument.
But counsel, didn't you actually get a copy of that executed lease?
Only after we sued them. I mean, right. Essentially what their argument...
How you've defined and responded has defined the value. You got that value. You got it later than you would have liked, but you got it.
No, I would say no, because we have damages. There is an interim period of time where we didn't have the contract. Certainly, we would not have the contract today if we didn't sue them. I don't think the law in Minnesota is that when a party fails to fulfill their contract, that when I sue you, and I'll say, okay, fine, I'll do what the contract says, that we now just simply move forward and say, oh, don't worry about it. The breach never occurred. Certainly the breach occurred. We've been damaged. We don't know the extent of our damages yet because we haven't been able to figure out what all was done here.
Mr. Stephenson, what about Mr. Lindahl's argument that the contract doesn't place any time requirement on when a competitor contract is provided?
Well, first of all, I think that the cases that are cited here, and I forget if it's the Park Lane or King case, talks about that documents have to be provided within a reasonable time. It doesn't say when exactly it has to be provided. I think what's important here is that the respondents, as alleged in the paragraphs of the complaint, refused to provide it. Their answer was, we are not going to provide you a copy of this contract, period. And we would not have received a copy of the contract, but for the fact that we sued them. That they cannot now get out of the breach of contract by saying, after we got sued, when we acknowledged we were never going to provide you the contract unless we got sued, that now we've somehow fulfilled our contractual obligations. That isn't the way a contract works, and it certainly constitutes a clear breach of contract claim in Minnesota.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stephenson. Your time is up, and I just want to thank both counsel. The case was well briefed and well argued, and it is now submitted to us. We will issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe. Thank you again.